cold weather getting you down? Warm up this season with amazing hot food to go at Old Farm Fine Foods. Pizza, frittata, sausage rolls, sandwiches, soups, and more are ready and waiting to get in your belly. Plus, you can also buy fresh and frozen foods to prepare at home and enjoy a huge selection of meats, cheeses, produce, coffee, beverages, and condiments. Pop into the shop Monday through Saturday between 8 and 5 at 204 Berry Street in downtown Kingston. And don't forget to follow Old Farm Fine Foods on Instagram at OldFarmFF. To get the scoop on the latest goodies. Old Farm Fine Foods, comfort food you can count on.
CFRC 101.9 FM has launched its annual funding drive to raise $25,000 to support station operations, news and creative programming, and upgrades to our recording and performance studios. You can make a difference. Visit CFRC.ca right now and make your gift. Get a tax receipt through Queen's University or get sweet CFRC swag and enter to win our weekly raffle draws featuring gifts from amazing local donors. More information at CFRC.ca. Thank you for your support.
G'day and welcome to a Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is CJ the DJ and I am your host for this week's Grad Chat. Of course, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs as well as CFRC, so thank you very much to both of them. Now, if your mates miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and a CFRC podcast. So no excuse not to hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. But today, I would like to introduce you to Logan Germain, who is doing a PhD in biomedical and molecular sciences in the drug development and human toxicology area. And of course, this is under the supervision of Dr. Louise Wynn. Welcome to Grad Chat, Logan.
Thank you.
It's good to have you here. So your research topic is the impact of the environmental pollutant tryptophanol phosphate on epigenetics in aquatic embryonic cells. A lot of big words there, and I did go to Mr. Googly, but do you want to give us a general overview? Because first of all, it sounds like it's doing what you're wanting to, bringing your environmental side as well as your toxicology, as well as your human embryonics.
Yes. So do you want me to just give a broad overview?
Yes, just give a broad overview to start with.
So basically, I'm investigating this specific chemical, actually called triphenylphosphate.
Oh, sorry. What did I say? Tryptophanol.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Which I will abbreviate today to TPP, just because it's easier to say.
Much easier.
So basically, this chemical TPP is used globally in Canada, as well as in Canada, as a flame retardant, which basically is additive to many consumer and industrial products to prevent the spread of flame and kind of slow the onset of fire. So it doesn't necessarily prevent fires from initially happening, but it will slow the spread of fire if one happens.
Right.
And so it's surprisingly added to so many things. Like the room we're in right now, I guarantee you it's in here with us.
Really? Should I be worried?
Well, I kind of describe it sometimes as a joke, like as a ghost, like it's in the room with us. Yeah. So it's added to like textiles, plastics, electronics, paints, lubricants. Honestly, the list goes on. So not only is it a flame retardant, it's also a plasticizer, meaning it gives things malleability. And so it's added to plastics to kind of give them more flex and malleability. And so, yeah, it's kind of a ubiquitous chemical. And it has a tendency to leach into surroundings. So in indoor environments, it's found often in dust particles, as well as in air to some extent.
Okay, yeah.
Now, in the environment, it's found primarily in water systems, as well as like soil and sediment.
Right.
However, it's also been found to be long-range transported all over the world. So it's been found in like remote Arctic regions.
So regions where none of this is meant to be.
Exactly. I mean, there is
because it's mining. Because it's man-made.
It's man-made. It's a synthetic chemical. But yeah, so it's found in regions where, you know, it shouldn't really be found.
Yeah. Not good.
Yeah, so it's also a very interesting chemical because it's not acutely toxic, meaning if you swallow it, it's not going to immediately, you know, kill you or anything or necessarily give you cancer. But it has, or it's becoming more evident that it has more like nuanced health effects.
Okay.
So specifically acting as an endocrine disrupting chemical.
Okay, which we are going to find out.
Yeah.
So, okay, what is an endocrine disrupting chemical?
Yeah. So basically it's a chemical that has a similar structure to hormones that would be found in our bodies. And so it's able to kind of mimic those hormones and bind to specific, I'm trying to avoid being like overly technical
no,
here,
okay.
But bind to like hormone receptors in our body because it looks like hormones in our body.
Okay.
Yeah. So in the case of TPP, it's kind of speculated to act as an estrogenic chemical.
Okay. So which is why you're in the human toxicology area.
Yeah. I mean, all sorts of organisms have estrogen systems, so it's not necessarily unique just to humans. But that being said, if it looks like estrogen, acts like estrogen, definitely there's human implications there.
Well, yeah, because we don't want a lot of unnatural chemicals in our bodies.
Yeah, so the hormone system in particular is extremely sensitive because hormones that circulate in our body are often at really, really small concentrations.
Right.
And they exert their effects at like very specific ranges. And so if you have external kind of like hormonal stimulus, you can really have big impacts on all sorts of different outcomes. So specifically, I'm interested in like developmental outcomes.
So developmental like outcomes, which is good because we all want to see, you know, as we're growing, are we growing in the right way? Cells and things aren't going to mutate, or we're going to have developmental delays or things like that. But
yeah.
You're looking at basically back in the beginning, the embryonic cells.
Yes. So again, this chemical isn't overtly toxic per se. So I'm not looking into like DNA damage or cancer. I'm looking into more how does it impact, like the endocrine pathways in our body. But developmental periods are particularly interesting because we'll have to get into this too, the epigenome.
Okay. I love it. I always find it fascinating when a student suddenly realizes, okay, they're not going to understand that word. How am I going to explain this one?
Yeah, we have to go piece by piece here.
That's
but
good.
Basically, in development is a very sensitive time for many different systems because it is so highly regulated in order for an organism to properly grow.
Right.
There's a lot going on during development, and any sort of external factors that can alter development can lead to later in life health outcomes.
Which makes total sense. Mm-hmm. And I guess the question for you is, how later in life is this going to show up?
Yeah, that is unknown. But I think I added here, there's this hypothesis called the developmental origins of health and disease hypothesis.
Yes, and why is that relevant to what you're doing?
Mm-hmm. So this is basically a hypothesis that's now been, you know, widely accepted as a framework that describes how exposures or environmental factors that happen during development, so like in humans that would be in utero during pregnancy,
right?
So like a fetus during pregnancy being exposed to either chemicals or stressors or basically like any sort of external influence that's not, you know, normal, perfect.
So when we talk about people who are on drugs or alcoholics and
exactly.
things like smoking.
Yes, exactly. All of those factors, even maternal diet,
right.
maternal stress, pathogens, like there's so many different things that can influence development. But basically the hypothesis is that many different later in life disease outcomes, so like the big ones that are often talked about are diabetes,
right,
obesity, even some types of cancer, they can be traced back to occurrences that happened during pregnancy in utero, because that's such a sensitive time in an
right.
organism's life course.
Right.
So that kind of programs the, you know, essential systems that might be dysregulated later.
That's tough. And I always think, huh, what happened in my life? Can I blame my parents?
Yeah.
Probably not. But there we go.
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, you used some of those words before, epigenetics.
Yes.
Do you want to explain that? And there was another word that I saw. Sorry. This is what happens when you go to Mr. Googly or Mr. Wikipedia. You go down a rabbit warren. And I saw something called transgenerational epigenetic inheritance, which I guess is kind of what you were talking about just then.
Well, actually, that's...
Or is that different?
That's different.
That's the gene.
Well, I'll explain it.
Okay, thank you.
But
that's
first,
probably better than me.
Yeah, first we need to talk about epigenetics. So I'm sure most people are familiar that we have DNA in our bodies.
Yep, we all did that in science class.
Yeah. So we have DNA that basically is, you know, the book that tells our bodies what are we made of, like what sorts of proteins, what sorts of cells are we going to have? What makes us, you know, unique?
Right.
And every single cell in our body, for the most part, has the exact same DNA.
Right, but it's only that little percentage that's different.
Well, actually, this is where epigenetics comes in.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, how is it possible that our skin cells have the same DNA as our, I don't know, brain cells, but they work so differently?
Okay, right.
Yeah, so a big part of that is epigenetic regulation. So there is actually a level of regulation over our DNA that controls what parts of our DNA are actually expressed and when.
Okay, right.
And that is epigenetics. I mean, it does other things as well. It's an extremely complex, nuanced topic, but today I'll just talk about it in this one way.
Perfect.
So,
because we've only got 29 minutes.
Exactly, yeah. So basically, there are these chemical modifications to our DNA and to basically proteins that control our DNA or the compaction of our DNA, that, you know, the outcome of these chemical modifications can change what parts of our DNA are actively being expressed over the course of our life. And it will change over the course of our life.
Right.
So when you're in utero in development, you're going to be expressing very different genes than someone who is 70 years old and no longer growing and is, you know, on the later end of their life.
Right.
Or especially too during puberty. There's like all sorts of
big growth.
Yeah, all sorts of growth hormones, growth factors are being expressed. And the careful regulation of that is, you know, a big part of it is through the epigenome. So one particular epigenetic factor that I think I will discuss today in particular is DNA methylation.
I've heard that word before.
Yeah.
Methylation.
So it's a very interesting regulation of our DNA. And basically, it involves adding, well, I don't know, a methyl group, some like chemical group to our DNA structure.
Right.
And it kind of prevents that area of the DNA from being actively expressed.
Oh, so it's blocking it.
Yes. I don't want to speak too narrowly here because it
right.
does a lot of things. But today, yes.
But essentially today,
we can say
it's, well, like you said, it's stopping it from doing its
Yeah, it represses
function,
it,
represses.
Silences that area of DNA.
Puts it to sleep for a
little exactly,
bit.
Exactly, yeah. I do just want to put it out there, that's not the whole story.
And that's very wise. People go, that's not true.
Yeah.
Yes. No, that's good.
But I think it's safe to say that for, you know, the general population, we can think of it in those terms.
Yeah. That makes sense to
me. Yeah. So DNA methylation is kind of a dynamic process over the course of our lives, which areas of the epigenome or genome are being methylated and which are not, are kind of dynamically changing.
Right.
And they're changing not only over development, but also due to external factors as well.
And is this where this TPP comes in?
Exactly. So chemical exposures also are able to change DNA methylation. And as you can imagine, that could have impacts on which parts of our DNA are being expressed.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of, you know, that can have health impacts, but not entirely sure what exact health impacts are being caused by TPP. That's where I'm kind of looking into it.
And that's the tricky part, right? Because you already said before, sometimes these things have an effect, but it may not be till later in life.
Yeah.
And so how can you pinpoint today at this particular section that that's going to have an impact?
That is an extremely...
What made you even think about that one?
About
TPP? Has it shown up somewhere else?
Okay, so there's a few parts to this question you just asked. But first, I will say that it is an extremely complicated endeavor to trace specific health outcomes to specific chemical exposures.
Right.
It's like very hard to do chemical risk assessments that will capture like latent effects of chemical exposures.
Right.
Especially in humans, because you can't really just give humans chemicals and see what happens.
Would be unethical.
Yeah. So that's where like animal models or cell models come in.
Right.
And so I'm using a cell model.
Which is nice.
Yeah. Which we can talk about after this as well. But TPP, there is growing evidence in the scientific literature. So I'm not the only person investigating this. There's a whole, you know, not necessarily team, but I feel like we're a bit of a team out there across the
world. I'm sure you are, yes.
Yeah, so people are looking into all sorts of different hormone pathways that are being influenced by this chemical in a variety of different models. Now, one model in particular that's pretty popular in this area is fish, surprisingly.
Right, which is where your title comes in, talking about aquatic embryonic cells.
Exactly. So there's a lot of evidence in fish that there are endocrine disrupting properties of this chemical.
Right.
And fish are interesting because, well, for one, they're obviously like aquatic species and TPP is found in water systems.
Right.
And I mean, it's important to care about animal species in general. But furthermore, they are being used in biomedical sciences as a model for development. For humans as well. So rodents aren't necessarily the only animal model that can be used to kind of infer what might happen in humans.
Right.
So yeah, there's a couple different aspects to this. But one being that the particular fish species I'm working with is extremely sensitive to its environment. And so I kind of like to think of it as a canary in the coal mine species.
Yes, yes.
That it can pick up on environmental changes, perhaps even before rodent species or humans would, but it can still kind of give a little warning that something might happen. So yeah, I'm using embryonic cells that are derived from a particular fish species called rainbow trout.
I love rainbow trout.
Yeah, I didn't know much about rainbow trout until I started this project, but they are pretty cool. They're in like a native Canadian fish species. Mm-hmm. They're pretty important for fish, like fishing economy.
Right.
As well as to indigenous cultures. So in and of their own right, they're an important species. But yeah, they're also, you know, kind of, in my opinion, a good canary in the coal mine species to investigate these kinds of chemical exposures.
So with that, though, as soon as we started talking about water and that this TPP gets into water, well, we drink water.
Mm-hmm.
And are we actually filtering the TPP out of our drinking water if it's there?
That's a good question, actually. I'm not sure the capability of like waste management systems mm-hmm. to filter it.
This is where we need one of the chemists to come in, or, you know, one of the engineers to come in and look at that next part.
I'm sure there's been studies on that. Actually, after this, talk, I'm going to go look that up.
I love it.
But
so,
okay.
So you're using fish, the rainbow trout.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, this is what you're looking at is a very small thing. How are you doing that? I mean, how are you finding whether this TPP is in the embryonic cell of a fish?
Okay, so I'm like purposely adding the TPP to the embryonic
cells. Okay, right. Fair enough, right. and then watching it develop.
Yeah, okay,
So you must have a control.
Yes.
And then what do
Maybe
you do?
Maybe I can backtrack a bit here to explain the experimental design. So this cell model that I'm using is something called an immortalized cell line, which is pretty cool.
And it means it keeps going?
It keeps going forever. It propagates, can grow forever, and it doesn't actually grow into a fish. It stays as embryonic cells.
Well, that's cool.
It is really cool. So that cell type will not continue to differentiate, meaning it will not continue into like skin cells, brain cells, etc.
Right.
It will just stay as its embryonic cell version.
Okay.
So it's very handy to be able to see what happens at that specific stage of development. However, it doesn't tell us what actually might happen in a whole fish down the line.
Right.
And this is a part of toxicology that is somewhat difficult, as I said, is that you need to kind of build the picture piece by piece. You know what I mean? And so I'm looking at one specific piece of the puzzle, but to get the whole picture, there will need to be other pieces of the puzzle.
So the part that you're looking at, you're saying you're adding the TPP yourself.
Yes.
Are you looking to see where it's binding, what's it affecting within that cell?
Yes.
And so that's the first bit.
Yes.
It's having an effect in this way at this point in time.
So the first question that I wanted to answer was, does exposure to TPP in these embryonic cells change the epigenome?
Right.
Because that was not known before this. I mean, there were some guesses that that it would. But my first part of my PhD project was to just see, like, generally, broadly, are there changes to certain epigenetic modifications?
Right.
And one of them was DNA methylation.
Right.
And so I did find that DNA methylation as a whole was actually being decreased in these cells following TPP exposure.
Right.
But that didn't tell us about what genes might be affected. It just told us broadly that this is changing.
Is that when this, what was that word, transgenerational epigenetic inheritance?
We have to come back. We got to come back to that.
Okay. Because I love that. I love that title.
Yeah. Okay. So this is kind of I don't know if it's necessarily still a hypothesis. I think that it has been like gaining evidence to support it. But basically, it's describing how an exposure during specific periods of development, again, a very sensitive time for the epigenome,
right,
can lead to reprogramming of the epigenome that not only will affect the life of the organism that was exposed, but can actually be...
But subsequent.
Yeah, ones. Subsequent generations may also potentially carry these reprogramming changes. So, for example, like in humans, if a pregnant person was exposed to some chemical, their fetus then experienced a change to their epigenome. That fetus grows up into an adult, goes on to have their own kids. Those subsequent generations may also have impacts, health impacts due to changes.
It.
Exactly. Even though they're no longer exposed to that chemical.
So, like normal genetics and inheritance, this is happening in the same way. I mean, throughout time, there's been mutations of our genes and things, and which has created us from being walking on four to standing, et cetera, et cetera. This is just another form of that, but this is a man-made environmental.
So, okay, I think
does that not make is that am I getting it wrong or?
It's kind of right. The important distinction, though, is that genetics and epigenetics
is very different.
Are different
yes.
systems.
Sorry, yes.
And although they are related in terms of epigenetics can regulate gene expression, they operate separately in terms of like genetics will acquire, you know, their mutations can be acquired over time, which can change someone's DNA.
Right.
But epigenetics is really interesting because it's so much more dynamic. Like it can change on, like, I want to say a daily basis, depending on what exactly is going on in an individual level. And so it's much more a system that is in response to external stimulus.
Right.
And so, yes, it responds. Definitely, it responds to chemicals, like man-made external chemicals. It can also respond to, like, normal hormonal fluctuations. Mm-hmm. So, like, for example, in women throughout their menstrual cycle, the epigenome can change too.
Right.
Or
right.
Depending on dietary factors. Like, there's so many things that can influence the epigenome on a much shorter time frame than DNA or, like, our genetics will change.
Which takes longer.
Yeah, that can take generations.
Well, that's a good clarification. So thank you for that. So with the work that you are doing, though, two more questions. One, has there been changes from different levels of TPP? Like, you know, here's a little bit, no effect whatsoever. Here's a lot more. Oh, this is where the tipping point for it to have an effect. So that was the first question. And then the next question is, with what you're learning from the rainbow trout embryonic cell, can that model be used for humans?
Okay, so first question, I have explored a couple different concentrations.
Thank you very much.
So firstly, obviously, I have a negative control, mm-hmm. no TPP. And I just see what happens to the cells without that, you know, influence. But I also have what I like to call, like, a midway concentration point. I don't think it's necessarily worth going into what they are.
No, that's fine.
And then I have a high-end concentration point. Now, what I found was that I didn't actually see much changes at the midway concentration point. And so I'm looking from now on specifically at this high concentration. Now, this high concentration is not necessarily environmentally relevant. It's actually higher than what would be found in the environment. But that being said, it still gives us mechanistic insights to what might be happening.
But also, wouldn't it also help on policy of, I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.
That was a question we had in here. Are there any sort of regulations?
Yeah.
You know, you can only have this amount of TPP, blah, 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 in certain things.
Yeah, exactly. So it definitely could inform policy decisions. Mm-hmm. Of course, like, you know, if you're seeing these effects at this high concentration, you do not want to find that in our water systems.
No.
However, I think it's safe to say that's not the concentration
right
in our water systems. Okay. It's much higher. The other part, though, is I'm only looking at a 24-hour exposure to these embryonic cells.
Right.
Versus organisms in the environment will be exposed their entire lives.
Yes.
So I need a higher concentration to see what's happening, you know, at this 24-hour time period. Because mm-hmm. I'm just really curious as to, like, how is TPP interacting with our epigenome?
Yes.
And, of course, like, in these embryonic cells, I can't do, like, a whole lifetime exposure.
No.
You have to be realistic about how are you going to investigate your question.
But this is the first part, right? Just to see, does it have an effect even at this short amount of time?
Yes.
This small amount of concentration?
Yes, exactly. And so back to your question about regulation on TPP, currently it is not regulated in Canada. There was a screening assessment done in 2019, and the outcomes of that screen assessment basically recommended that Environment Canada add it to our toxic substances list, meaning it would then be regulated to some extent. The specific kinds of regulations would be dependent on the risk assessment.
Right.
However, as far as I'm aware, because I try to keep up with this, but maybe something changed this morning, I'm not sure. But as far as I'm aware, it is not yet added to the toxic substances list, meaning it is not yet regulated. The use and disposal of TPP is kind of free for all, as far as I understand.
Could be one day.
Hopefully it is regulated one day, because I think the evidence is really growing that it has endocrine disrupting properties. But this is kind of like a new area in risk assessment, in my opinion, is the changes to the epigenome. As far as I've been able to tell in my readings of risk assessments for chemicals in Canada, changes to the epigenome are not considered. So
Which is interesting after what you've been telling us today.
Exactly.
Well, Logan, thank you so much for coming on the show and explaining about your work. It's been fascinating.
Yes, thank you.
So that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat sadly comes to an end. Don't forget you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. Just type in Grad Chat. Until next week, this is CJ the DJ signing off with a big hooray.
Hey everyone, this is Joseph Guido. I am CFRC's Airwave YGK Musicians in Residence Project Intern. Do you love local music and supporting local arts? CFRC's annual funding drive is running until December 31st, and your gift is needed to help us provide local musicians with modern, top-of-the-line equipment, space, and technical support to better showcase their creativity on our airwaves all year round. Help us raise $25,000 this year. Make your gift today via cfrc.ca.
Cego.
Buju anim.
Danach a ak anzeni shuk with an.
Tante.
Ei, inu halingay.
This is Words and Culture, a series on Indigenous languages, funded by SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada.
Ai inoratikai marlan alakarel lawunga uqartigi niaqtasinnga tamatumani kharitaujakkut nala hattalangatillugit inuttitu khausivunni pitchutikharlunga.
Hello everyone, I'm Madeline Alakarelak and I'm your last host in these amazing episodes of Words and Culture. I am an Inuk woman who was born and raised in Canada's second most northern community. If you can have a quick look at a map, you'll spot Resolute Bay. That's far, hey? Yeah, still in Canada. A quick fact for you. My family was forcefully moved way up to the high Arctic in the 1950s from a community called Inukjuaq, and that's in Nunavik here in northern Quebec, so that Canada can be Canada. We were used as flagpoles. I was raised by my grandmother Minia Lekarelek, an ancienne Piroxataoloktuvinivunga Inuktitukisi Miuharun Narami. She only spoke Inuktitut, and as a little girl myself growing up, I would have to translate for her. She had many visitors from around the world of tourists who tried trekking and who did trek to the North Pole, as Resolute Bay was a pit stop. She even sewed many of their clothing because it is extremely cold up there. Long story short, my grandparents, Anansiakuk, Atatsiakuk, they used faith to survive the hunger, the lies, the heartache, and the very dark winters up there, because in the winter it's 24-hour darkness. So I learned to read in Inuktitut from the Bibles they had, and I learned to interpret for my Anansiak by learning English from school. Now, there are many Inuit who live and come from the circumpolar Arctic. In this case, my guests and I are Inuit from Canada, and we speak Inuktitut, though others, Inuktitut, also speak Inuinnaqtun. And there are many dialects, but in these days, we can mostly understand each other. Louise and I have raised our children in Iqaluit, that's the capital city of Nunavut, and the hub for Inuit from across our territory. And I'll be introducing you in these episodes to my Inukhati. These are my fellow Inuit. They are working so hard to keep our language alive, and they're doing all kinds of amazing things, like starting an all-Inuit TV channel, and by describing what it's like to leave a life in an outpost camp to attend school. And then also we're going to talk about what lateral violence is doing and hurting to so many parts of our cultures, including our languages. But I'm going to talk to them about what they are doing to address those issues. My first guest today, though, she owns a book publishing company. She is originally from Kayaptugapik, also known as Clyde River in English, and she grew up with Inuktitut as her first language and learned to read Inuktitut from the Bible as well. Tana ukhakhatigi siyaga kayaptugapi miu ingyaktupi uyaktuti ukhasurisuriga kitaya mga tusang naritsugit. Here is my conversation with Louise Flaherty. She's the co-owner of Inhabit Media, the first Inuit-owned and independent publishing company. But I also love their dialect in Inuktitut. So I just wanted to go back a little bit to your life in Kantawapik. Many of our listeners may not know that Inuit have different dialects. We have a universal language, Inuktitut. I've always found that people from Kantawapik have such a beautiful dialect where it sounds like singing to me. Have you ever thought about that?
growing up speaking it, I have never noticed it, that I never thought that we were singing, but only until recently when it was pointed out, I started trying to listen. What do they mean when we speak in a singing tone or singing manner? And it's probably because of our hey.
Yeah, it's really beautiful. Yeah. So you grew up only speaking Inuktitut?
Yes.
When did you learn to speak English?
I think I only started learning in grade one, because I grew up with my late grandparents, who I called my Anana and Atata. Although I also grew up with my parents as well, but I was raised by unilingual Inuktitut speakers. So I spoke it until I think we were in grade one when we were starting to learn English. And not long after, when they received, of course, mail, they'd be in English, and they would ask me what this letter was. At a very young age, I started reading documents that were too advanced for my little mind. Yeah,
that's amazing. I share that. I share that with you, as I was the interpreter for my late Anansia, my grandmother. So they really depended on us because they didn't speak any English whatsoever. So with that in mind, have you held on to that with a passion to create books in Inuktitut? Or where does that passion come from?
I think it comes from, I grew up reading. Of course, when my Anana, my late grandmother, found out that I was able to read in syllabics, she put me in the church choir right away. So where text had meaning. So the hymns, and of course I read all the Sunena Tusiutit prayer book. Knew it almost by heart. I could probably lead a service as a child. So anyway, my parents were subscribers to Reader's Digest, Mom to True Story. And so we had encyclopedias. We had books. But going to school, there were very limited books in Inuktitut. They started appearing, but they were done by hand with ditto machines that our classroom assistants prepared for us students. And going to school and then going to teacher education and having been a teacher, there were books when I became a teacher, but again, they weren't coming fast enough. And I wanted my grandchildren to be able to see themselves in the books that I couldn't see myself in. When I drew pictures as a kindergartner, they'd be blonde with blue eyes standing next to an apple tree, which I've never seen before.
That is so cute. And I think we all share similar stories in a sense where we were basically born and raised speaking Inuktitut and having learned English. But given that, I think we also noticed the decline in Inuktitut speaking. And how, with what the work you do as a publisher of books, how would you like to change that?
I've been trying to do my part. I mean, it comes with challenges because, as you know, as Inuktitut speakers, we have so many dialects. And we have freelance translators that will translate some of our books into Inuktitut if they were written by educational authors. And they are in the language or the dialect of the freelancer. But unless the author submits their work in Inuktitut first, it's in the author's dialect. So I've been trying to make sure that our youth have documented published books that they can refer to, which we could never do when we were looking for terms, words, even just stories. Yeah, so it's very important because not with the residential schools, our parents, my mother definitely grew up with a notion that, because it was drilled to them, that in order to get in life, you have to know and be able to speak in English. With my generation, I think that changed, where we are reclaiming, reviving our language more. But then it comes at a fault where, because they grew up listening to the language and that it wasn't very important, to change that mindset is harder because they almost won, right? Mm-hmm. Up to now, people still hear, oh, you have to learn English in order to get ahead in life. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's good that we are bilingual, but it made me realize the importance of being able to speak in my language, and my language had importance when I was taking teacher training. We used to have Wednesday seminars, and one of our instructors always, our seminar topics were always thought-provoking. And the question was, is Inuktitut important? That whole seminar, an hour of it, made me realize, wait, my language is just as important because I've been brushing it aside. So since then, I've been almost like on a mission to make sure that our language is visible.
Mm-hmm. And so much kudos to you. Anyone who's working on revitalization of anything, I think, is a hero to me, because it's a lot of work and you're up against all the things that were taught in residential school, as you mentioned. But for our listeners' sake, as you mentioned, you were a former teacher. Even people in fellow Canadians don't know where Nunavut is, or for the fact that there are Inuit right across Canada from Tuktoyaktuk all the way to Labrador. So to try and describe in Nunavut specifically the dialects, what do you mean when you say there's different dialects for our listeners?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, there are main dialects in four main dialects in Nunavut. Saniklok being the most south is more in part with Nunavik. Qikiqtaaluk is almost divided into South Baffin and North Baffin, and Clyde River being in the center is a mixture of both. And then we have Kivalliq speakers, and they have various dialects because they are from different tribes as well. And then we have Natsilik and Inuinaktut. So in even saying that, each community has their specific little dialects amongst themselves, right? I'm right next where I grew up, right in between Qikiqtaaljoq and Mittimakalik Pond Inlet. And I grew up listening to both dialects. And mine is a mixture of Panirtuk, with my Anana coming from Panirtuk. So you become aware of the differences. And instead of my way of saying is better than your way of saying it, you just have an appreciation. You learn to become multi-dialectal when you have an appreciation for dialects.
Mm-hmm. And so does that pose challenges to the books you're coming up with when you're dealing with the author speaking a different dialect than the translator?
Sometimes we will, but we'll ask authors which translator they want, because we have a list of freelancers from various communities. And we ask them, does it matter which dialect it is in? In most cases, it's not. But when it comes to creating educational resources, I think different communities are wanting to see books in all their dialects. So that would be one book times 25 different variations, right? Mm-hmm. Which is a challenge if you have been given a small portion of money to do all those, which we don't have. Mm-hmm. To me, Inuktitut is one language, because we can understand almost everyone now being exposed to, and I guess living in Iqaluit is a bonus, because it's, like you said earlier, it's a hub and people from all over are here in Iqaluit. So we hear lots of dialects among speakers. It was never a challenge. Mm-hmm. And instead of saying, I mean, I worry, because if we have this dialectal fight, mm-hmm. Nothing will progress, right? Because mm-hmm. what you are given, you can understand. It's just a different way of saying a word or a term in this whole book. That you will probably have to ask what this means. But then again, I always use the Bible as an example, because our grandparents learned to read from the Bible, which was in one dialect of whoever that translator was. Mm-hmm. And nobody stood up and said, this is wrong, it's not in my dialect. And nobody threw that book in church, right? Mm-hmm. It was used. Mm-hmm. And if there were terms that people did not understand, they made sure to learn what it was. And it becomes a great learning opportunity, because you're adding new words to your mind, to your vocabulary list.
Now, going back to that, to the Bible and the hymn songs that we all learned at our generations, I don't know if everyone knows that Inuit culture was an oral culture, whereas mm-hmm. all the stories that we have heard to this day were passed on orally, and many are mm-hmm. hundreds of years old. So mm-hmm. with that in mind, what is your mandate as a publisher to keep those stories alive?
We started off with creating books from legends, because we can't document them fast enough. The people that lived out on the land are quickly passing away or passing over, coming from an oral tradition. Like you said, our language is very old when it comes to even the Ayarangnak, the string games that we have, our stories. So that they were told through Ayarangnak as well. And some Ayararusit figures in our string games go back to the woolly mammoth days, where there's a word for kiligvak, which is that. And it tells you how old our language is, right? So, but we are trying to document everything as fast as we can. For our future generation, who will only have these books to refer to if we don't strive to learn our language and teach it down to our grandkids and great-grandkids.
I love that you mentioned naming. I mean, there's so many beautiful things about language and culture, but the specifics of naming in our culture, I find so beautiful. Who were you named after?
I actually have 9 names.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And so during the time I was born, I guess there had been some deaths in friends of our parents and friends of our grandparents, and the names, most of my namesakes are male, and so I grew up as a Inuk to a lot of our community members. I was a boy through my namesake, so I wasn't taught how to sew, how to clean skins, other than to have to help my grandmother. But I grew up hunting mm-hmm. and butchering. Mm-hmm. And that's because of the names that were bestowed upon me.
And so, speaking of butchering, hunting, sewing, skinning, these are a lot of things, unfortunately, that many of us didn't get to learn for whatever reasons, and residential schools plays mm-hmm. a big part in that. And so how would you like to reflect those teachings in books? Is it possible?
Yes, it's possible. We have started creating, we have an awesome book called Caribou Clothing from Igloolik that we did with a researcher. And we have books now on kamik making, on hunting practices, on survival. If an author comes to us with a story idea, we'll look at it. Almost all of our books are educational books. They teach children, people, about who we are.
So where do you see our language going? Where do you see Inuktitut headed? Namot la. From all your experiences, how do you see the status of Inuktitut?
I think we have to change the trend. I think we have to do our part instead of pointing fingers at that person's not speaking Inuktitut. We have to start within ourselves. Otherwise, if we keep thinking or expecting someone else to speak, we're going to lose it, because we have to make our language cool. We have to make sure that our youth are hearing it.
So going back to the Bible that was written by someone who wasn't Inuk, so Inuit mm-hmm. learned to read in syllabics, and it's similar to the Cree writing system. With that in mind, what difference would a unified writing system do for us, in your opinion?
We have dual writing system. We have the syllabics and Roman orthography, Kaliuyakpet and Kaniuyakpet in syllabics. When you look at social media, a lot of the youth are reverting to Roman orthography. And we do have some books that are now in Roman orthography to reach those audience. I believe for people that are trying to reclaim the language, that already know how to read in English, that it's easier as long as they know what EUA is. That's the only difference, because we use EUA as our vowels, right?
Can you do me a favor and go back to your teaching days or grade one days and share the Inuktitut alphabet? Can I say alphabet in syllabics for us?
I did teach kindergartens, and what I used was the ibitiki gaminisili ibirikingishli, and then ukutuku gomonosolo yuvokungutu
apataka gamanasala yavara kangasla. What would you like our listeners, wherever in the world they may be, to know about Inuktitut and why we love it, and why it's important to understand that we still have people that do not speak English and speak mm-hmm. only Inuktitut?
Mm-hmm. I've attended World Indigenous Conferences on Education every 3 years, I believe. We all have the same Indigenous story. There are some speakers. Again, I have come across people that have not moved forward because of their dialect fights, which is not going to stop me, because if we keep fighting about dialects, we won't progress. We're just going to lose our language. I mean, we have done a lot of work to to preserve our language and our culture. I would encourage fellow Indigenous friends and Indigenous people around the world just to move ahead and take initiative instead of just waiting around mm-hmm. for other people to do it. Because mm-hmm. when it comes from you, yourself, it's authentic. It's authentic Inuit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I appreciated so much of this conversation, and we will continue the conversation as Inuit, as we support each other in the work that we do. Thank you so much, Louise Flaherty, mm-hmm. I wish you all the best in continuing this important work.
Thank you so much, and I don't think I have time to age and grow very old because we have or retire because there's so much to do, right?
That was my conversation with Louise Flaherty. She's the co-owner of Inhabit Media. It's a book publishing company. And I respect how she says that we're all going to lose out if we just keep on fighting over what dialects we should be using to tell our Inuit stories. Our languages keep us connected, you know, the same way music forges a connection. I would like to dedicate this song to my grandparents. Nakupmitaka sapililok simangituning inuanansi akukatapaunga nutolok simatilugin. To my grandparents, thank you for not giving up. Here's Tujad. Yes, that would be me and my cousin. We were a duo a long time ago. And Tujad was also the name of our community. Here is a song called Kayusita.
Ships that took us far away, sailing through the broken ice towards the shores of paradise, where they say our new life will begin. I can't wait until my ship comes in, landing on the edge of Ellesmere, wondering if we could survive here. Half would stay, the rest of us were on our way. Will I see my family again? I can't wait until my ship comes in. Can you see time sail on? I can't wait until my ship. Our final destination reached. They left us standing on the beach, planted there like human flags that winter's fury turned to red. The hunter showed us emptiness again. I can't wait until my ship comes in. Could you see dark till my ship comes in? Nobody ever wins. I can't wait until
him I should come to him. I think I hear voices in the wind telling me my ship will soon come in.
That is a song called Kayusita by my former group, Tujat. Kayusita means let us move forward, and I want to teach you how to pronounce it. Kayusita. Kayusita. Kayusita.